org. From WBUR Boston and WRNI Providence, this is Boston University's World of Ideas. I'm Gina Cervetti. Each week, we bring you the best of Boston University from the worlds of scholarship, letters, politics, and the arts. Tonight, Reconstructing Iraq and Afghanistan, a panel discussion concerning human rights, infrastructure development, and the region's fragile political culture.
There are two basic problems. First is security, and second is reconstruction. And in both of these areas, the international community, while proposing very laudable plans, has really failed in implementation.
Three experts address the issue of what happens next, reconstructing Iraq and Afghanistan tonight on Boston University's World of Ideas. First, this news.
From NPR News in Washington, I'm Craig Windham. American officials are condemning today's suicide bomb attack in Baghdad that killed six people and injured dozens of others. Quick action by guards who fired at the attackers kept them from getting close to a hotel that was full of Americans in Baghdad. NPR's Ari Shapiro has more.
The State Department calls the car bombing a vicious act of terrorism. Spokeswoman Amanda Batt says the U.S. does not yet know who is responsible.
U.S. officials in Baghdad will be working closely with Iraqi security officials to ensure that those behind this attack are brought to justice.
The U.S. Civilian Administrator for Iraq also issued a statement of condolences. Paul Bremer said, quote, "Neither the coalition nor the Iraqi people will be intimidated from our path to a democratic Iraq." A pair of suicide attackers detonated the car bomb outside of a Baghdad hotel. The hotel remained largely undamaged, but bystanders were wounded and killed in the explosion. Ari Shapiro, NPR News, Washington.
Palestinian Prime Minister Ahmed Kareya told Palestinian officials he might resign next month after agreeing to head a 30-day caretaker cabinet. NPR's Lindy Gradstein reports from Jerusalem.
Earlier today, Correa suggested he was going to resign, but officials close to Correa later said he could remain in office even after the next month if Palestinian leader Yasser Arafat agrees to the cabinet Correa wants. The two men have been arguing over whether Correa's choice for security chief Nasser Youssef will get the job and what powers he will have. Meanwhile, United Nations officials said at least 1,000 Palestinians were left homeless after a two-day Israeli incursion into the Rafah refugee camp near Gaza's border with Egypt. At least 8 Palestinians, including 2 children, were killed in clashes during the Israeli incursion and dozens of others wounded. Linda Gradstein, NPR News, Jerusalem.
Southern California has been hit with its first supermarket strike in more than 2 decades. After talks broke down last night, unionized clerks went on strike against the Vons chain, and 2 rivals, Albertsons and Ralphs, locked out union workers today. Hundreds of supermarkets and tens of thousands of clerks are affected. Twin Egyptian boys who were joined at the top of the head have been separated after a marathon operation in Dallas. Dr. Dale Swift, one of the surgeons involved at Children's Medical Center, says the most difficult part was dealing with portions of the boys' brains that were touching.
We knew that the brains would be, you know, sort of sticking, touching each other, but we thought in most of the cases it would be they'd peel apart relatively easily, but at this location, they did not.
Swift says the boys will be kept in a medically induced coma for a few days to help them recover from the surgery. In Rome today, 4-month-old twin girls who were joined at the temple were successfully separated. The surgery less complicated than most for conjoined twins because the girls did not share any organs. This is NPR News.
Good evening in Boston. I'm Gina Tempesta. A Massachusetts woman is dead after the car she was riding in drove into the Merrimack River in Bow, New Hampshire last night, trapping her inside. Police say 27-year-old Rena Shackelford of Brighton died this morning at Concord Hospital. Police pulled her from the car last night after it had overturned in about 6 feet of water. The driver, 28-year-old David Shackelford, also of Brighton, had escaped from the car before it submerged. Police believe speed was a factor and say the accident remains under investigation. The highly anticipated Game 4 between the Yankees and Red Sox canceled tonight due to the weather. Game 4 will be played tomorrow night with Game 5 now set for Tuesday in Boston. Meanwhile, Pedro Martinez and Manny Ramirez of the Red Sox were fined today, along with Don Zimmer and Kareem Garcia of the New York Yankees, for their actions in Game 3 of the championship series. Bob Watson, baseball's vice president in charge of discipline, did not announce specifically why the four were fined, other than to say it was for their behavior in the fourth inning of yesterday's game. The amounts of the fines have not yet been disclosed. In the forecast, clearing skies tonight with lows into the 50s. For tomorrow, sunny, milder with a high around 70 degrees, and partly cloudy on Tuesday with highs in the mid-60s. Right now it's 56 in Boston.
We're funded by you, our listeners, and by the MathWorks, creators of MATLAB and Simulink technical computing software, dedicated to accelerating the pace of discovery in engineering and science worldwide, MathWorks.com. By SitterCity.com, featuring profiles on more than 2,000 Boston babysitters. Complete sitter profiles searchable by time, references, location, and more. SitterCity.com. And by the Robert Wood Johnson Foundation, making grants to improve the health and health care of all Americans, on the web at rwjf.org.
Good evening, and welcome to Boston University's World of Ideas. I'm Gina Cervetti. Tonight, we have a panel discussion entitled, What Happens Next? Reconstructing Iraq and Afghanistan. Presented by Boston University's Core Curriculum Current Affairs Association, tonight's discussion features three panelists who address issues concerning human rights, infrastructure development, and the region's fragile political culture. Dr. Lynn Amowitz teaches at Harvard Medical School and is senior medical researcher with Physicians for Human Rights. Dr. Amowitz recently returned from Iraq, where she was investigating and documenting health and human rights violations. Professor Thomas Barfield is chair of the Department of Anthropology at Boston University. He has traveled extensively throughout Afghanistan, researching the nomadic peoples of Central Asia. During the past 2 years, he has been a frequent advisor to the U.S. government on reconstruction in the post-Taliban era. Professor Paul Zemanski teaches in Boston University's Department of Archaeology. He is a recognized authority on ancient Mesopotamia and has worked on numerous excavations throughout Iraq. He has spoken and written widely on the fate of Baghdad's Museum of Antiquities and is a consultant on reconstruction efforts involving the Iraqi cultural heritage. Moderating the discussion is International Relations major, Boston University sophomore John Gorin.
Good evening. I'd like to welcome you to the Core Current Affairs Association's first forum of this academic year. Tonight we have three speakers with direct and very recent experience in Iraq and Afghanistan to discuss particular aspects of the war and the extremely difficult process of reconstruction. Specifically, we will hear about the most talked about example of post-war looting, namely Baghdad's Museum of Antiquities, about the prospects for stability in post-Taliban Afghanistan, and human rights. Each panelist will speak for about 15 minutes, after which we will call on you to ask questions. Our first panelist is Paul Zemanski, professor of archaeology at Boston University. His academic expertise is in the Bronze and Iron Age archaeology of ancient Anatolia, Syria, and Mesopotamia. Professor Zemanski has supervised excavations in Iraq, and he knows very much about the area. He has recently returned from Baghdad, where he helped to administer a substantial grant intended to assist in rebuilding the Iraqi National Museum. Since the Iraq War, Professor Zemanski has spoken and written extensively on the devastation suffered by Iraq's ancient treasures. We welcome Professor Paul Zemanski.
Well, as an archaeologist, I'm rooted in the past, and this is supposed to be about the future. I'm not very good at social reconstruction, and I don't think I've repaired anything without a Swiss Army knife in a long time. So I will just try to be very brief about my experiences in Iraq and what I think is going on. I, first of all, would sort of like to review the changes that I've seen in the country. I started working there in the early 1970s, so I guess I've had 30 years of off-and-on experience in Iraq. And every time I go back, it's a different country. When I started out in 1973, the expedition I was on was more or less confined to a dig house out in the desert. We had very little interaction with anybody besides officials of the Antiquities Service and the villagers who were our workmen. I remember the isolation was tremendous, and I remember showing a picture of the Chicago skyline to the guy who managed our house, and he simply didn't believe it. It was something that was too far away from any of his experiences. When we went back in the 1980s to initiate a major field project, the country was really booming. There were big eight-lane highways, despite the fact the Iran-Iraq war was going on. There was enormous prosperity in the country, but security was still very much the watchword. Everything in that country was done in the name of security. It would have done John Ashcroft proud. We were not, for instance, allowed to have a camera that had a lens that was more telephoto than 135 millimeters on a camera. That was considered spy equipment if you went beyond 135 millimeters. The kind of thing that you have on every digital camera right now would be absolutely taboo. Computers were out of the question, all this sort of stuff, and you did not talk politics to anyone at all. We went back again in the early 90s after the Gulf War. We were there for Aggression Day, the first anniversary of the bombing. And what struck me on that occasion was, first of all, how upbeat everybody was and how pro-American they were. I remember talking to a doctor who said that when the bombing started, he and his kids all went out to watch it. It was kind of like a fireworks display. And I said, "Weren't you a little worried?" And he said, "Oh, no, I knew the Americans weren't going to bomb us, personally." Everywhere we went, there was this great optimism. The country was being rebuilt. Now, granted, it was a whole year after the war, but electricity was back on. The only sad thing for us, or not the only sad thing, there are many sad things, but the main problem was that antiquities were just off the board in terms of anybody considering them. It wasn't important anymore to do archaeology. The salaries weren't high enough to keep anybody in the Antiquities Service. The museum was closed. The regional museums were looted. All the vehicles of the Antiquities Department had been taken away by other government departments, so that even when they heard about sites being looted, there wasn't anything the Antiquities Service could do, and they didn't hear about it very often because they didn't have any telephones. But in general, it was you could talk to people. It was and at that point, people, I think, thought Saddam was on the way out, and they did talk politics. It was the first time you could really talk to Iraqis, and they were not afraid to say what they thought of Saddam. And in any case, I think things got very sour after that. I think the embargo really was perceived, unlike the Gulf War, the embargo was perceived as an action against the Iraqi people. And the Iraqi people, not Saddam, suffered very much because of that embargo. In any case, when the war broke out in April, the Antiquities Service became very conspicuous in the news because initial reports suggested that the entire Iraq Museum had been cleaned out in looting that took place between April 8th and April 12th. All the while, there was an American tank sitting out in front of it, but taking no action to stop the looters. Those initial reports were not nearly, fortunately, proved not to be true. The museum did not lose its entire collection. It lost 10% of its collection, and many of the objects that were stolen have been recovered. There was a little exhibit of the Nimrud gold, something we worried about tremendously. A lot of gold, precious materials that were found in royal tombs of the Neo-Syrian queens right before the Gulf War broke out. Really spectacular archaeological treasure that had not been adequately published. We felt it was at great risk. It turned out all the time it was still in a bank vault where it had been put in 1990. It had never been brought back to the museum, so it was perfectly safe. In any case, the CPA, Coalition Provisional Authority, thought it would be a good idea to have a museum exhibit to reassure everybody that everything was okay. And on the 3rd of July, they did that. They brought the Nimrud gold out of the bank vault where it had been soaking in sewage, put it on display. There was a big press event, everybody was enthusiastic to see that the museum was back on its feet. And, of course, it lasted exactly 2 hours. They closed the museum, and it's not scheduled to reopen for another 2 years at best. But in any case, at that point, there was a great deal of concern with antiquities in Iraq. Money was flowing in, and I was there as part of this sort of relief mission that a large number of organizations, the Mellon Foundation, the State Department, David Packard had donated money to get equipment back into the museum, to get the museum started again. We wound up taking it there because the State Department is apparently at war with the Defense Department, and they felt if they sent anybody in with their money, they would not be allowed to spend it. They would simply be put on a military base and not allowed to interact with the museum people. So they said, well, you can do this because you're private citizens. So my wife and I took the money and bought furniture, computers, digital cameras, arranged to have the museum's doors and windows restored, the administrative facilities set up. And we weren't the only people doing this sort of thing. British Museum has sent conservators. There's a lot of stuff flowing into the museum now, so I think the physical facilities will be repaired. The damage to the university was really severe. We went and visited the campus of Baghdad University. We went to two medical schools in Iraq, and the devastation there was really extraordinary. In particular, the archaeology faculty at Baghdad University had nothing, absolutely nothing. They'd had one computer in the department before, and that had been stolen. They had one slide projector, and that was broken. Their classrooms had been burned. It was just absolute devastation. And yet, despite the fact that it was 130-plus degrees, they were finishing up classes in July because they actually extended their semester to cover for the hours lost during the war earlier that spring. So things were kind of functioning. Nevertheless, Baghdad was in poor shape. There was sewage standing in the street. There were no police on the corners. Every intersection you came to was a madhouse of people negotiating who had the highest testosterone levels or whatever to get around. In other words, there are no traffic laws. People are driving on any side of the street they feel like. Every on-ramp is an off-ramp. Public statues were disappearing from display. There's a statue of Sadun, a big bronze statue. Sadun is a statesman who is not a controversial character of the early 20th century. There's a main street in Baghdad named after him. We went to work on Wednesday, and his statue is standing there in the middle of the street, and we came back Wednesday afternoon, it was gone, stolen in broad daylight to be melted down by somebody or other. There was simply no law and order there. There was nobody to report a crime to. People were wandering around the streets, and if somebody pulled out a gun and demanded your wallet, that would be fine. There would be nobody to report that crime to. The U.S. government was not, or the U.S. forces were not acting as a police force in that sense. And in fact, one of the things we were concerned with was the trade in illegal antiquities, where these things that had been stolen from the museum had gone. And we asked one of the senior members of the U.S. team that is operating on this, you know, do you know where these things are? And they said, yes, we know exactly where many of these things are being sold in Baghdad. We know what part of the souk transactions are being made in. And we can't go there. It's too dangerous. What we could do is a sweep. We could take 100 people in sort of clean this place out, but a lot of people would die. I mean, on both sides, there'd be shooting and so forth. It just isn't worth it for a bunch of antiquities. They said, now, you know, later on, Iraqi police can go in, make some arrests, but for the moment, we can't do that. So that's the sort of thing that is not being done. While we were there, electricity was a very spotty sort of thing. We stayed in a quite nice hotel and were quite comfortable because they had a generator that worked most of the time. They turned it off in the afternoons to give it a rest. But basically, we could sleep at night. But most Iraqis could not. There was no clean water. There was sporadic electricity. And I think everybody was getting pretty fed up. As far as we were concerned as archaeologists, the thing that was really bad what was going on in the countryside. Sites are being looted now at a rate that is unprecedented. A sort of industry of looting sites grew up during the embargo as a way that people could get little things and sell things. This became increasingly organized. And after the U.S. occupation, this became rampant. There are now large gangs of up to 300 people, armed, organized, out ripping these archaeological sites apart, destroying the archaeological contexts of whole cities and civilizations for the sake of trinkets, tablets, cylinder seals, and so forth that they can sell on the art market. It is a losing battle at the moment to try to stop this. And again, it would require the application of real military force usually these guys just wave when the helicopters fly over. This is all part of this larger problem of living in a society that is basically anarchic at the moment and seems to be getting increasingly so if what I read in the newspapers is true. I left there on the 5th of July, and so I'm not up to date on exactly how things are. I had, as a house guest this last week, the man who's just been named the director of museums for Iraq, and he is more upbeat than anybody I've talked to and anybody I've heard from in the press. He says, you know, there's a bomb here, there's a bomb there, but it's a big country. I think he says we're exaggerating how bad things are. That remains to be seen. In any case, I don't know what we can do as long as unemployment remains at 60% in this country. The museum, for instance, had a hiring freeze that was imposed by CPA. And it seems to me at a time when you want to rebuild something, this is the last time that this is the worst possible time to have a hiring freeze. Such things as the last harvest harvests are normally purchased by the government in Iraq. This is what farmers grow things for. And the CPA was a little slow to do that, so all the farmers are suffering. People in the countryside don't have any way of making a living, and that's why they're going out and looting sites. So the situation with antiquities is very much tied to the whole problem of reconstruction in general. That until you have some way of enforcing the laws, putting people back to work, the situation with archaeology is going to be the same as with everything else. There isn't going to be any kind of serious scientific work done there, nor are we going to stop the damage that's being done by these looters. I don't suppose I should say a lot prescriptive. I don't know how to govern a country, but it does seem to me, just standing on the street watching American patrols go by, you can see what the problems are. American soldiers wearing their uniforms in Kevlar in that heat, driving around in vehicles, are suffering a lot. But they look like Martians to the Iraqis. It does no good to have them drive down the street in a half track pointing guns at people. It just makes people nervous. The communication difficulties are too great to solve any real problems of the street variety by doing this. And the sooner we can get law enforcement back in the hands of Iraqis, the better. I think it's very important, just from what I've talked to the Iraqis I've talked to at least create the perception that the resources that are flowing into Iraq are going there for the benefit of Iraqis and not for the benefit of companies like Bechtel and so forth that are controlled by foreigners. I think this is there's a real, when you talk to Iraqis now, there is an anti-American strain in all of this that was not there before. There's real fear that we're there to get their oil, we're there to take away their antiquities, and I hope we can design mechanisms. I don't think these things are true, but I hope we can design mechanisms to at least reduce that perception. In any case, I'm going to be part of this because we've just received a very large grant to help rebuild Iraq's universities. And I expect I'm going to be spending quite a bit of time in Iraq over the next 3 years for the course of that grant. And we'll just see how well this reconstruction project works. Thank you.
Thank you, Professor Zemanski. Professor Thomas Barfield has been the chairman of the Anthropology Department here at Boston University since 1989. A Harvard graduate, Professor Barfield has done fieldwork in northern Afghanistan, western China, and Uzbekistan. Professor Barfield has published numerous works on the nomadic peoples of Central Asia. During the last 2 years, he has been a frequent advisor to the U.S. government on economic development and post-war reconstruction in Afghanistan. We are honored to have him speak tonight. Professor Barfield.
Well, thank you very much. Afghanistan has entered a real critical period that many people may not be aware of. The Constitutional Committee has finished its work, and the Constitution itself is to be revealed in a week or 10 days, to be debated at Aloy Jirga, an assembly in Kabul sometime in December, and elections are scheduled for June. This has really focused the attention of Washington on Afghanistan because suddenly much of what the United States and the international community has done is going to come up, at least in some way, to a referendum in Afghanistan. And one of the things that's happened over the past 20, 22 months since the fall of the Taliban is that the track record of the international community in Afghanistan is not particularly good if you're going up in terms of elections. Because unfortunately, we've really wasted 20 months in terms of reconstruction. Very little has actually been done on the ground, and the Afghans are very keen observers and highly critical ones. There are two basic problems. First is security, and the second is reconstruction. And in both of these areas, the international community, while proposing very laudable plans, has really failed in implementation. The reasons for these failures have a lot to do with how the international community got involved in Afghanistan, how it decided to carry out the security and reconstruction. And we are now sort of inheriting the consequences of that. The Taliban actually fell rather rapidly, much more rapidly than many people expected. Some people were looking for a long guerrilla war in southern Afghanistan. But as northern and western Afghanistan fell very quickly after the fall of Mazar Sharif, southern Afghanistan surprisingly fell as essentially the people in southern Afghanistan threw out the Taliban, or at least told them to get lost, and announced that the Taliban were gone, which to some extent they were. But this then led to a difficult situation, and the international community decided to leave international forces only in the capital. The forces in the capital, known as the ISAF forces, effectively helped the Karzai government maintain stability in the capital. But while there was considerable enthusiasm for a certain amount of troop deployment in the months that followed the war, the longer time went on without any such deployment, the less enthusiasm there was for it. And this created a problem. The United States, which has a division of troops based in Bagram, which are largely fighting remnants of Taliban and al-Qaeda, say that we're not involved in internal security. The international forces said, well, we're not really interested in moving beyond Kabul. And the control of these forces turned over on a six-month basis. Most recently, however, this has been reorganized, re-coordinated, and it's now a NATO command, one of the first out-of-region NATO commands that that treaty organization has undertaken. But the difficulty is, during this time, what we have is effectively international forces in Kabul and no international forces outside of Kabul. What this has allowed is effectively for regional commanders, pejoratively known as warlords, that range anywhere from people who might win elections in their regions to bandit kings, they certainly are a wide variety, to maintain their power in regional levels and to some extent in some areas particularly to oppress the local population, but also to make it very difficult for the Karzai government in Kabul to extend its control beyond the capital city. So we've got a real difficulty of a constitution coming into being, elections coming into being, with a government that really doesn't have a mandate that extends beyond Kabul. So the question is now, will we extend international forces beyond Kabul? One reason this might be effective is that, except along the Pakistan border, we do not have a lot of internal problems in Afghanistan. Unrest, yes, banditry, yes, but sort of civil war, no. And effectively what the international community would be doing by putting in these international forces is doing warlord control, because it's imperative that these local commanders and their militias be disarmed. But no commander wants to be disarmed if he's not sure his enemy is going to be disarmed. And nobody trusts the central government to do disarming because they're perceived of as the warlords of Kabul. So essentially you need a neutral broker to do this. You need international forces in the countryside. And although Afghanistan has a well-deserved reputation for throwing foreigners out, it is true in this case that foreign troops would probably be welcome in most of rural Afghanistan if predominantly to protect the local population from what they see as abuse by local leaders. So it's an unusual situation. And if you look at it compared to the amount of killing that goes on in Iraq and the difficulty there, by contrast, Afghanistan is much more quiet except along the Pakistan border. Now, if we take a look at reconstruction, what we essentially see is many promises but little action. And in particular, this is on the reconstruction that the Afghans value most, particularly roads. And I should say, when I'm talking reconstruction of Afghan roads, I'm not talking reconstruction of an interstate highway. The Afghan main highway is a two-lane blacktop road. All right? It's a road that you would get in rural New Hampshire. This is not high-tech. And yet, somehow, we have been unable to fill the potholes. Because people have been unwilling to figure out how to give those contracts, how to hire local Afghans, how to do anything. While some progress has been made recently, when I went up into the Selang Pass last year, the bridges had been blown. This was to keep the Taliban out of the mountains. No one had bothered to come up to repair these bridges, so instead what the Afghans did was take crushed Soviet armored personnel carriers, stack four of them one on top of another, and put a steel plate. That was the main bridge that linked North and South Afghanistan. And the Afghans said, well, isn't there an entire American army here, 20 miles? Couldn't they come up for a weekend and do an exercise, you know, like temporary bridge, and we could place it later? No, we didn't do it. Because, in effect, the military said, we don't do reconstruction. And the international community, by and large, wanted to do, particularly the United States, wanted to do reconstruction by hiring large multinationals. Well, large multinationals, 3 or 4 years, we'll hire our own people. They didn't see any urgency in getting this done. And in particular, it was difficult to do contracts with local Afghans because, well, they didn't do road building the way we did road building. And after all, they didn't have accountants and things like that. So how could they sign contracts? In other words, we were treating this as a problem that could be put off without realizing how important this was to the Afghans. And this has built up a lot of resentment. It's also meant it's been very difficult to get the economy off the ground, because how can you move crops from city to countryside or countryside to city if you don't have roads? Similarly, irrigation canals need to be redone. That has not been done. Power systems in Afghanistan need to be revived. But unlike Iraq, where people complain they don't have power, most Afghans never had power. Only 11% of the country was electrified before the war. But there are things that you could easily do because, for example, Tajikistan has a surplus of hydroelectric power. If you connected a northern Afghan grid with Tajikistan, you could electrify half the country without even putting in a new dam, a new power plant. A little bit of creativity needs to be done. And the Tajiks would be happy to do that because their Uzbek neighbors refuse to pay them for their electricity. So an alternative market might work out. But probably the greatest difficulty, because when people say, well, you're exaggerating, we have put a lot of money into Afghanistan. The international community has put a lot of money into Afghanistan, but it's largely been in humanitarian aid. Now, let it be known, Afghanistan desperately needs humanitarian aid. Schools, clinics, hospitals. All of these are in desperate need for Afghanistan. But the difficulty is humanitarian aid does not get reconstruction done. So what we find is international NGOs pretty much coming on the humanitarian side and nobody really coming in on the infrastructure side. And yet it's the infrastructure that really needs to be done in Afghanistan. Let me turn now very quickly to the question of political reconstruction, because as soon as this constitution is going to be released, we are going to see a tremendous amount of controversy in the press. The conservatives in Afghanistan will say it's a radical document, that it's un-Islamic and should be rejected out of hand. The international community says this is not what we look. It does not meet international standards of human rights. Let me explain why this problem exists and that it's been a long-term problem in Afghanistan for at least the past 75 years of a long-running dispute between what one might call modernists in Afghanistan and conservative Islamists in Afghanistan. And the issues that are coming up now came up in the Constitution of 1964. They came up in the Constitution of 1923. This is not new. In particular, for example, what do you do about the role of Islam in a country like Afghanistan? One has to remember that with the exception of a few hundred Sikhs and Hindus, all of Afghanistan is Islamic. So In diversity, what we're talking about is the diversity of the Islamic sects. And one of the improvements that this constitution will have is the recognition that all Islamic sects in Afghanistan will be created equally. For Afghanistan, this is a remarkable improvement because in the past, the Sunni-dominated governments tended to discriminate against the Shias. But from the international point of view, and Afghanistan has signed the relevant UN charters and treaties, this will not allow for freedom of religion. It will not allow missionaries in the country. Conversion to other religions will remain an offense, a criminal offense, and perhaps a capital offense. And Islam will not have an equal status to any other religion. It will have a superior status to any other religion. And the fact is, whether you're a modernist or an Islamist, pretty much all Afghans think this is the way the world should be. So we have a problem. While this will be a great improvement for Afghanistan, to the outside community, where's the individual right to choose your own religion? Do we have sort of the best becoming the enemy of the good? And this is going to be a difficulty that needs to be worked out. On the other hand, when Afghanistan says it wants to be an Islamic state, and many people worry, well, what does that mean? As far as Afghans are concerned, an Islamic state is a state governed by Muslims. It doesn't necessarily have any particular ideological color to it. Because unlike other countries in the region, Islam is so deeply embedded in Afghan society that Islam cannot be used as an ideology. This is the difficulty the Taliban had. Afghans would not accept being told what Islam was or what it wasn't by a bunch of Arabs. After all, they said, who won the jihad, us or you? You know, they told the Arabs to go back and fight their own jihads, but that they were true Muslims and they weren't going to take any advice. Similarly, Sharia law. Legal scholars will argue that the Constitution is not clear because the Constitution will say all Afghan laws must be in accord with Sharia, that is Islamic religious law, but in accord with does not mean Islamic law itself. Why that little quibble? It means that the mullahs will not be interpreting the law. The state will be writing the law, but the state will say to the mullahs, but of course we would do nothing to contradict the major tenets of Islam. But they will make sure that there's no mullah supreme court, as there is in Iran, to say what is not Islam. So what we're going to see here is a debate that has gone on for a long time in Afghanistan, that will attempt to embody values that Afghans hold together. But to some extent, a lot of these compromises will not be clear or satisfactory, either in the international community or inside Afghanistan, because at the moment, the Afghans do not want to fight over any kind of ideology. They had a communist government, which was the high water mark of the modernists. They had the Taliban, which was the high water mark of the Islamists. And right now, the thing that Afghans most want is a government that's not concerned with ideology and that gets down to the business of reconstructing the country. They have also pointed to the international community that if you don't do this, if you don't help reconstruct the country, we will return to what we were for the past 10 years, a failed state that can be the home of any movement, any radical movement that wants to rent a country. And one thing the United States and the international community does not want to see is a return to that type of failed state. So while I would argue that we have made an error in terms of not taking advantage of the opportunity to really get reconstruction done, it is quite true that neither the United States nor the international community can afford to abandon Afghanistan. We've seen the consequences of that in the past, and neither we nor the Afghans want to see those events repeated. Thank you.
Thank you, Professor Barfield. Dr. Lynn Amowitz is Senior Medical Researcher for Physicians for Human Rights and Instructor in Medicine at the Harvard Medical School. Dr. Amowitz specializes in international women's health and human rights. She has traveled throughout the world monitoring health and human rights issues. Her work has taken her to Sierra Leone, Nigeria, Kosovo, and most recently, Iraq and Afghanistan. Her work with Physicians for Human Rights has been used by the United Nations, the World Health Organization, the U.S. State Department, and the Afghan Ministry of Health. It is a pleasure to welcome Dr. Lynn Amowitz.
Thank you. I guess my job is to sort of tie the two together, and since I've been to both countries and spent the last 5 years traveling between the two, I have to come up with some sort of mix to be able to say how they're tied together. So the one thing that I can say is that both countries have suffered with years of abuses, more than 20 years. In the case of Iraq, 35 years. In the case of Afghanistan, when I started in late 1999, more than 20 years of abuses. And what do I mean by abuses? I mean human rights. And every time I say human rights, everybody's eyes glaze over. So what am I talking about? Simply, I'm talking about electricity, food, shelter, clean water, freedom from torture, the right to vote, freedom from discrimination. These are all rights that are set out in the Universal Declaration of Human Rights. Remember, that was a document that came into existence in 1948 after the horrors of World War II. But that's a non-binding document, and there are other documents that have since come into play, which are covenants which are binding, such as the rights of the child or freedom of discrimination for women, etc. Many of those are signed on by states or by countries. So the way that we can tie these two countries together is, if you listen to our two previous speakers, they've all talked about the lack of electricity, the lack of shelter, the lack of schools, the lack of clinics. They all have a health consequence. And what Physicians for Human Rights believes is that every human rights violation has a health consequence. Think about it. If you're tortured, your health is bad. If you can't vote and you can't stand up for what you believe in, your health will be bad. You won't be able to advocate for your needs. If you can't work, you won't have money. You can't buy food. Your health is bad. Any way you go down the path of any of these human rights or these human needs or human freedoms, however you want to call them, you're going to end up with a health consequence, which is where I and Physicians for Human Rights have spent a great deal of time documenting. Our organization is an organization that looks at research and advocacy. We're very different from groups such as Amnesty International or Human Rights Watch. We don't just do testimony. We do large population-based studies that gives numbers. And then we also do those same things, such as testimony, to give the color or the face to those numbers. Sometimes numbers can be boring and people don't really want to listen. But if you say, this woman told me this awful story of how she was tortured, how she lost her baby during the beating, and then you say, and she represents 92% of women that I interviewed, that's a completely different scenario than if you just say that this woman told me this. In addition, it helps you to be able to plan for reconstruction. If you know that 97% of internationally displaced persons in one country suffered sexual violence, your planning is very different than if you interviewed 100 women who told you that they had been sexually violated. You don't know how big and what scale you need to do. So let's talk a little bit about Afghanistan. I spent years in Afghanistan before the war, during the war, during the bombing, and after the war. I was taken into Afghanistan during the Taliban years by people that basically put their lives in danger to get me in and to do surveys of women and men in Afghanistan. What did we find? We found that depression rates among women were extraordinarily high, and that a lot of their reasons for depression were not simply just the usual deprivations of food and shelter and lack of security, but also because of human rights violations. And the most astonishing thing that we found, which everybody didn't believe, was that both men and women supported human rights, and even more so than what we found in Iraq most recently, that Afghans do support human rights and do want them as part of reconstruction. We also found that security was an issue, and I don't need to belabor that any more than Professor Barfield has. Security has been an issue. It is an issue. But one of the bigger things that we found in the reconstruction process in Afghanistan was that reconstruction was urbanized. It was centralized in Kabul. Health and Human Services wanted to set up state-of-the-art maternal mortality clinics in Kabul, but didn't want to deal with the poor women in the villages who were delivering alone or without with a traditional birth attendant who had not been trained. Women's rights were important to both men and women. And whether they will or will not be in the Constitution, and in the Constitution in accord with international conventions, is still yet to be seen. And although there is an effort to do that and a Ministry of Women's Affairs, the power that they have is quite limited compared to what they could have. Let's move to Iraq. I started in Iraq in March. I went before the war. We were afraid that if we did not position before the war, we would not be able to get in. That was a good gamble. All flights were shut down during the bombing and just before the bombing in Iraq. I was there from March until the end of July. In the beginning of the war, I spent most of my time in Kuwait, in what was called the Humanitarian Operations Center set up by the military. This is a whole nother discussion that humanitarian aid organizations are now having to work with the military or the Department of Defense, who are also trying to set up humanitarian aid and humanitarian support. As I said, Iraq had suffered 35 years of abuses. The ones that we know about the most and the ones that Physicians for Human Rights have documented were the gassing of the Kurds in the late 80s. Physicians for Human Rights was the first to document that sarin was used against the Kurds and also testified to the Senate and the Congress that this was a genocide against the Kurds. At the time, the U.S. was supporting Saddam and did nothing about that. What was unknown was in 1991, when the Shia had an uprising, and there are two sects within Islam or more, the Sunni and the Shia. The Shia had an uprising that was supposedly supported or spurred on by the U.S. military, but then not supported physically or actively by the U.S. And there was what we would call probably a genocide of the Shia during the 1991 uprising. Because of Iraq's inability to allow people to that area and wanting to keep it quiet, no one could get there, and there was very little known about what happened in the South in 1991. We decided to look at that, but we also decided to look at issues of reconstruction, justice, and governance, and to also make sure that we talk to everybody on the ground, including the Coalition Provisional Authority, or the Americans, those guys that are running the country, known as the Department of Defense. The U.S. and the British forces in this war became an occupying force. Now, what does that mean? It means that by the Geneva Convention, they have all the responsibility of security, of making sure that humanitarian needs are met. And if they can't do it, they must help humanitarian aid agencies get to where they need to be. And these were discussions that were ongoing and are still ongoing. Unfortunately, because the CPA, or the Coalition Provisional Authority, has decided that it wants to run reconstruction in Iraq, which is probably not the best way to do it, they have sidelined the United Nations and humanitarian aid organizations, who are the experts in international development. They're the experts in doing this all over the world. They have the training, they have the people, and they have the knowledge. Unfortunately, this is the first time that the Department of Defense has decided to reconstruct. Now, this is sort of an oxymoron. Department of Defense breaks things. It doesn't necessarily fix things. And to say that they know how to do that without international support is kind of a stretch, if you want to say it that way. One of the issues that we found in our surveys was that the Iraqis were getting quite dissatisfied with what was happening. Reconstruction in Iraq is slow. Electricity was not coming on. When I was there in June and July, it was 125 to 130 degrees. In the beginning, I was camping in the desert with military units because it was the only safe place to be. And by the end of June, I was staying in local hotels that had a generator, but the generators weren't strong enough to run the air conditioners. So if you can imagine spending your entire day in 125 to 130 degrees outside surveying from house to house every day for 15 days, then you can imagine how hot it is for everybody else who lives in that area. One of the things that we found in Iraq, which was a bit disturbing, was that 50% of men did not support women's rights. And what do I mean by women's rights? They didn't support education for women. They didn't support work for women. They didn't support freedom of expression, participation in government. The governing council is 22 men and now 2 women. One has been killed. So men are not going to be able to advocate for the needs of women. And the 2 women on that governing council are not going to be able to stand up to the 22 men and say, hey, we need this for our constitution and we need this for our rights. And this is definitely a concern of ours. Other things that we found was that most people wanted some type of justice. 81% of people were willing to give their names for a case for any type of justice. In other words, they wanted to tell their stories. This is quite different from what we found in Sierra Leone, where we literally got a handful of people that were willing to give their names and their stories, whereas in Iraq, 81% of the more than 2,000 households that we interviewed were willing to give their names. Now, why is that important? You can't move forward in a society that has had this much abuse if you can't tell your story and there's no accountability. And the accountability mechanisms that need to be done in Iraq in order to move forward, in order to reconstruct, should be Iraqi-led, but need some international mentoring. And why do I say that? Remember, this is 35 years of Saddam's regime. There was corruption. There were Ba'ath Party members who have now been reinstated as judges and lawyers, and these are very serious war crimes. We found torture, we found killings, we found beatings. There are more than 150 mass graves already found in Iraq, with more to be found. And in order to be able to try such serious war crimes without international mentoring for some type of justice system, there will not be an appropriate accountability process that follows international norms. In addition, when we asked people what type of justice they wanted, 22% thought that torture, revenge killings, hangings in the street, and all types of other heinous crimes would be appropriate justice. Now, is that because they're angry, or is that because they just don't know if there's another system that can be done? And a lot of this is felt to be that if there were some education about alternatives to what they feel, that there may be a way to make sure that justice fits international norms. So again, and not to belabor this, Afghanistan and Iraq have both suffered enormous human rights violations without accounting for those on both accords and making sure that everybody is protected, minorities and women, in the Constitution as they're forming, which is a unique process which is happening now, not yesterday, not 10 years ago, but now. Then these countries will be able to move forward as long as there is adequate support for reconstruction and appropriate reconstruction. Thank you.
Thank you, Dr. Amwitz. We're now ready for your questions. What would you like to ask our guests tonight?
Yes. This question is for the entire panel. As you did your research and your surveying, et cetera, what were each of your experiences in terms of opposition from the Iraqis or from the Afghans? Did any of them say, well, you're just another American, you know, out to take my oil? And second of all, as you were in your hotels and supported by the military, did you encounter any journalists there? And did you interact with any?
Shall I start?
As archaeologists, you're always heavily regulated, and whatever country you work in. And we got nothing but cooperation out of the Iraqi Antiquity Service. It was a wonderful outfit to work with in the 1970s, 1980s. They had a good system of laws. They worked quite well. One got permits. You had government representatives who were there to assist you and also to make sure that you did not transgress, steal objects, and so forth. I think there was a certain measure of suspicion that you might be, you know, that you might smuggle things out of the country, so they kept an eye on you. There was always a suspicion that you were a spy, so we were not allowed to photograph things like camels, gas stations, all because of security. But basically, it was a fairly cordial working relationship. And, you know, that's not the same sort of thing, I think, that the others have done, because we were really interested in looking at antiquities. And basically, it was a cooperative relationship. What happened, of course, with the embargo was that we were no longer allowed to go there. We were not allowed to take any money in, and without any money, you can't do any archaeology. So that sort of brought things to a halt. But there were still cordial relationships, I mean, via well, I can't say there was much email, but, you know, we did attempt to correspond. They attempted to have conferences and things like that. And whenever you saw anybody in Iraq, you know, particularly after the war, they were just delighted to see you and delighted to have any contact with you. But through all of this, one did not discuss politics. It was just simply too dangerous to talk politics under Saddam.
For Physicians for Human Rights, let me just clarify that we do not work with the military. In Iraq, because of safety issues, I did have to stay in a military base for safety reasons. But as soon as I felt that the safety was okay, we moved out of that into hotels, local hotels. We have never had a problem in Afghanistan or Iraq. We don't necessarily wave a flag that says that we're Physicians for Human Rights, but we don't deny it either. So most of the time we went in with locals. I did a lot of dressing as a local. So although I never wore what you would call a burqa, I definitely wore a headscarf and Afghan dress. I was always polite. I met with all officials, Iraqi or Taliban, at the time to explain what I was doing, and had never had any resistance to what I was planning to do to the surveys that I was doing in either countries.
Some final questions, yes.
One of the arguments for going to this war put up by the administration was that it would affect the overall region, that you would hypothetically install democracy in Iraq and that it would permeate to the area and affect the area. And I guess my question is, is that really possible? Can you institute a democracy in a country that has almost no tradition with, in fact, what it is, it's a tribal society, and many of them are all tribal societies, and can you instill democracy in a place that has no tradition with, you know, liberal democratic institutions such as, well, I know some have judiciaries, but some don't. Is that possible? Can you do that with them having being tribal societies, and does this concept of, you know, them, the democracy permeating through all of the Arab land, is that possible?
I think the Iraqis should make the decision whether they, what type of governance they want. There have been polls that have stated that they like the American democracy, but I think ultimately it's not up for us to decide, and one of the things that Physicians for Human Rights tries to do is to get the voice from the ground. And I think that that's the one thing that's lacking for us, or I say us meaning the U.S. government, to go in and say this is the way that it's going to be is going to cause more problems than simply asking what is appropriate for that society.
But as a policy, I mean, from the American State Department point of view, let's say, the premise that you start off with, that we come in and we create a democracy and demonstrate how it can be done and it spreads outward, there's a counter thing. If we go in and completely screw up, it shows exactly how badly things can really be. I mean, we can really shoot ourselves in the foot here, and maybe in the process of doing so. And so it's very important that this, you know, that this country hold together, and that the reconstruction not fail and it doesn't disintegrate. And, you know, this is one of the reasons why, you know, I think it's important that we really do invest in this reconstruction and do the best job we possibly can.
I'd like to join with you now in thanking tonight's speakers.
You've been listening to a panel discussion entitled, What Happens Next? Reconstructing Iraq and Afghanistan. Participating in the discussion was Harvard Medical School Professor Dr. Lynn Amowitz, Boston University Department of Anthropology Chair Professor Thomas Barfield, and Boston University Archaeology Department Professor Paul Zemanski. Tonight's moderator was International Relations Major, Boston University sophomore John Gorin. For a CD or cassette of Boston University's World of Ideas, call 1-800-909-9287. That's 1-800-909-9287. CDs and cassettes are $15, which includes shipping and handling. Tonight's program was produced by John Parati and Matt Largy, with help from Boris Strapochki. Our web producer is Angel Cozzelli. I'm Gina Cervetti. Thanks for joining us. Massive stone figures seem to guard Easter Island. Their stern, impassive faces stare inward across the island as they have for hundreds of years. The builders of these sculptures have long since vanished, but their culture can still whisper to us in the island's traditional crafts, dance, and music. Join Sylvia Pagioli and visit Easter Island as part of our next Citizens of the World tour to South America. Call 800-909-9287.
This is WBUR. Coming up just ahead at 10 o'clock after the news, it's BBC Assignment. In the forecast, clearing skies overnight with low.